Hi, everybody. I am Doc Crandall, and I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, I'm sober tonight. You know, when I introduce myself as being an alcoholic, I mean just that. And I, you know, even back when I was a young fellow, I thought like an alcoholic. I didn't know at the time that I was thinking like an alcoholic. I remember some of you old folks that are over 100, like I am, can remember the Thin Man series. And they were always walking around. They always had a cocktail in their hand, and they had a little pooch that followed them around. They were coming off in the top of their heads with these one-liners. They always had plenty of money. They dressed very well, and they had that long limousine and was in nothing but the best of nightclubs. And this was back during the 30s, and I didn't have any damn money, and I'd go see those shows, and man, I wanted to be like them. Never saw them drunk. They were always drinking and never saw them drunk, you know. I thought, oh, man, that is the life. I wanted to emulate them. And back in those days, drinking wasn't that important to me. I would go sometimes maybe 2-3 weeks without taking a drink. No red flags went up, and they should have at that time in my life, because every time I took a drink, I got drunk. It was impossible for me, even then as a young fellow, to go out and have a drink, you know. You hear these people now that go out and do a little experimenting. They say, well, I just went out and I was going to get a drink. We don't get a drink, we get a drunk. And there is a difference between a drink and a drunk, you know. I got to where the last time, you know, a drunk, you consider going on a drunk, you know, at one time was a one-night stand. And then it got to the point maybe where I'd be gone for a week, and then maybe a little longer than that. But the last time I took a drink, I stayed drunk 7 years. It wasn't quite like the Thin Man. It didn't come off quite as well as he did. I was a Marion drunk. You know, he always had these beautiful gals around him. Myrna Loy played the. She was always dressed to the hilt, and he had her on his arm. That didn't happen to me. I don't know how I went wrong. I drank the same kind of booze, I think, as he was drinking. Yeah. There was a good many years in my drinking career that I think maybe I might have had a little fun. I could put a little lampshade on and dance on top of the table and let my hair down. And I had that youth going for me, and I could get up in the morning and maybe feel bad for half an hour and shake it off and go on about my business. And it wasn't too important. It was important to me to this extent. You know, I was a young man in a hurry. And it was during the Depression in the 30s, and I was a workaholic along with being an alcoholic. And any time I would smell booze on anybody's breath during the week, I thought, my God, there's something wrong with these folks. You know, that was the time to be working. The only time I drank then, it had to be an occasion. It had to be a party of some kind. Somebody's birthday, or somebody was throwing a party at their house. I never thought of dropping into a bar, particularly during the week, and having a drink. I've quite often heard Descartes mention the fact that economics plays a big part in our alcoholism, and it certainly did with me. I got into sales work where I was traveling a lot and became quite successful. That is, successful to the point of making money. As I look back at it now, that our culture, and it is still the same way today, but our measurement of success is determined quite a bit by the number of dollars that we are making. That is the yardstick that is used. And I well remember many times during my life where people would mention to me, and they were congratulating me on how successful I was. I hadn't been a good son. I got married, I wasn't a good husband. We had children, I wasn't a good father. I wasn't a good employee. Then I had my own business, and I wasn't a good employer. But I made money. People say, yeah, you're successful. And I was sick enough to believe them. There wasn't any phase of my life, as I see it today with my set of values and priorities that I have today in my life. There wasn't any part of my life that lived measured up to what I term today as being successful. You know, how my alcoholic mind, it reminds me of the story of the young fellow that was going to college. His dad was footing the bill. He was a heavy, heavy drinker. And he was skipping classes, and he wasn't getting good marks, and using all of his money to drink and hang around the beer garden. Finally, it got to the point where his landlord had kicked him out, and his furniture was all piled out on the curb. And he was sitting there, and he was all hungover. He was in terrible shape. And he was sitting there and he was writing a letter to his dad. And he was telling him of all the troubles that he had, and he'd been kicked out of his apartment. His grades were low and he was afraid he was going to get kicked out of school. And he was putting the tap on the old man for a little bit more money. And a friend of his come by and saw what kind of shape that he was in and how badly he was hung over. And he laid a pint on him, and the kid sat there and he drank this pint, and finally he remembered what he was doing. And he picked up his paper and finished the letter. And he said, Dad, if you ever need any help, please let me know. Typical alcoholic. That was part of my insanity. I couldn't, you know, when I first came into AA and they started talking about recovering from insanity, I just thought, what are these people talking about being insane? I'm not insane. I might have drank a little too much. I'm not insane. I remember one old timer saying to me one time, he said, you're the kind of guy that sat at the end of the bar paying more than you should for a shot of booze and throwing it down your throat and trying to act sober. That's insanity. I have never been able to do that, keep pouring booze down my throat and be sober. But I wanted to be sober no matter how much I was drinking. I love the pickle story. You know, that tells about the insanity of this thing. The guy that was working over here, what was this plant that they closed up over here? General Motors owned it, you know? The guy was working over here in the General Motors plant, and he came out to his car, and it was in July and hot and sweaty. He runs out to the parking lot and gets in his car and reaches down under the seat and pulls out a jar of pickles. He looks all around, makes sure that nobody was watching him, and he unscrews this, and he ate a couple of pickles. And, oh, man, that was good. And he drove out of the parking lot, and he gets a couple blocks down the street, and he had a hankering for a pillow, pickle. So he pulls off into a side street and gets his jar of pickles out and unscrews it and eats another pickle. And he looks at it, and damn, they're friend are gone. So he stops at a drugstore and buys three more jars of pickles. And he stopped twice more on the way home and got some more pickles. He drove into the carport and looked around, nobody's looking. So he hid two of those jars in behind some wood there. Walked into the house and his wife had supper ready. And, hell, I don't want to eat. And he rushes upstairs and finds a jar of pickles and he gets another one. Now, you know, us booze hounds that have done that many times with a jug of whiskey, we look at that poor guy and we say, hell, he's nuts. You know? He isn't wrapped very tight. He isn't wrapped. I never got put in jail for eating pickles. But this obsession that I had with booze and what I thought booze could do for me. And it grew over a long period of time. And what it did to my head, what it did to my attitude towards life and towards God and towards people, towards myself. It was terrible. I became that real cynical so-and-so that, this is the way I'm going. And if you want to go, fine. Grab a hold and hang on. But I didn't care what the happiness of other people, or if I continued on down this way, what happened to the people around me, or I had no thoughts about them whatsoever. And I wasn't raised that way. I wasn't raised that way at all. I married at a very young age. I waited until I was 17. I was a father when I was 18. My first wife, I was a marrying drunk. In fact, Eileen, which a lot of you people in here know, my present wife, between two of us, we've had 10 marriages, and a few that we didn't get the paper with, you know, that I just kind of worked out of my hip pocket with them, you know. But my first marriage, I was 17, my wife was 18. We had three children at a very young age. We were both alcoholic. We were married 22 years. She died at a very young age of only 42 of cancer. And she was sober for 5 years in AA, happily sober, before she died. I wasn't able to make it at that time, but we'll get into that in a few minutes. But we had a very turbulent marriage. And I was in sales work, and I did a lot of traveling, and when I first went out, I was home every weekend, and then it was every 2 weeks, and finally it got to be 5 and 6 weeks at a time I'd be out on the road. And this didn't happen just in the period of a few months, but over a period of years. The progression of the whole alcoholic syndrome, it just is tremendous, but it's such a creeping thing that I didn't notice. I didn't know what was going on in my life. I don't know if I had have known if I would have done anything about it. There certainly should have been some red flags that went up, to warn me about this, but it never did. Early on in my life, the dollar bill became my God, and it didn't make too much difference. Most of the things that I was involved with in those days, I guess they cleaned them up an awful lot now, where I was living out on the edge. It was a fun thing. It was an exciting thing. I was in the encyclopedia business for 16 years. I had a great number of people out working for me. I had over 1,200 people out with kits selling encyclopedias. And I was able to make a lot of money, but my whole set of values and priorities were completely distorted. And it wasn't because of the upbringing that I had, and there was never a time in my life that I consciously said to myself, well, I'm going to go out here and mess up a lot of people. I'm going to mess up the heads of a lot of people. And I did that in the organization that we had, and the way that they were trained, and it's a hard thing to explain today. It isn't something that I am proud of, but it's something that I was involved with. It was part of my life, and as I say, the more successful I become economically, the deeper I got into the hole here, and the less that responsibility I had as far as my family is concerned about things that are important to me today. I didn't have that sense of responsibility. It just tickled the hell out of me today when I hear people that are, the way they perceive things and why they got into a, the folks that are coming in today that are in their 30s. And I never had that perception of life and that I was doing wrong. I don't know how I could have missed it. I don't know how I could have felt that I was doing so well when there wasn't a phase of my life that was... You know, I talk here and I've mentioned a couple of times that I had the capability of making some money. But after I got it, I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know how to handle it. I blew it all. You know, I was always just a step ahead. I was handling a lot of money. And it didn't mean anything to me. So there wasn't any phase of my life or the perception of life as it is today just wasn't there. I had no real values at all. And I think that, you know, that when they talk about alcoholism, that is the ism that crept up on me for over a long period of time. I made my first AA meeting in 1951. I didn't get sober until April of 1967. That is a period of 16 years. And you'd think that anybody with a half ounce of brains to be around AA. And during that 16-year period, I made a tremendous number of meetings. Tremendous number of meetings. But I didn't have anything going for me good. You see, I was all during that period, I was a non-believer. I didn't believe that he was there. When I introduced myself tonight and said that I'm an alcoholic, and that by the grace of God, I'm sober today, I mean just that. I mean just that. I don't. It isn't shaded in any way. I believe today, of course, that God works through you people. By the grace of God working through you people, I'm sober today. But during this 16-year period from 1951 until 1967, I had a lot of dryness. I had a lot of dryness. But I didn't have any sobriety. I was a non-believer. So what could the 12 steps mean to me? You know, I knew all the buzzwords. I could come in, you know, at one time during that period, I had 3 years and 8 months that I didn't take a drink. And I was at a meeting probably every day. I made a tremendous number of meetings. And as I look back at it now, I stayed dry just through the fellowship. But the policy of that is I had to leave that part of the country. And I didn't have anything of my own to take with me. And I'm an alcoholic. It was inevitable. It's just a question of time. And I had to come drunk. There was no other way for it to happen. I mentioned earlier that about 7 years. You know, when I hear people today in meetings, and they come back in and they say, well, I've had a slip and I was out for 3 days. And I feel so good for them that they're back, but it just scared the living hell out of me. Hell, I can hang by my thumbs for 3 days. That's no big deal, you know. Going out and getting drunk for 3 days. It just scared me because during that 16-year period, I used to sit in meetings and look for those loopholes. You know, the old story about W.C. Fields. They caught him. He was a known agnostic. And they caught him one time reading the Bible. He said, what the hell are you doing? He said, I'm looking for loopholes. You know? I used to set meetings and look for loopholes. I remember one time I was out in San Francisco. And a guy come busting into the meetings and he'd been out drunk for a week. And I said, what happened to you? Why did this happen? He said, well, a streetcar hit me. You know, when I left the meeting that day, I was looking for a streetcar. You know? I could pick up any kind of an excuse that you fellas ever put forth. And for somebody to come in and say, well, they've been out 3 days and they're back, that's good. That's good. But let me tell any of you folks here that you have absolutely no assurance as to when you're going to come back if you do get back here. There was a time when I would be able to, I thought I had the best of both worlds. I thought, you know, there was a time when I could go out, say, on Thursday like this, and I'd have an appointment for next Monday. Then I could go out and get drunk over the weekend. And maybe I wouldn't make that appointment on Monday, but I would call them and set it over, and I'd get there on Wednesday. I would get there eventually, sometime. Sometimes, hell, I'd surprise myself and I'd make it on Monday. Yeah. But I couldn't always do that. And the progression of this disease, it kept getting worse and kept getting worse. Now, I had absolutely no intention whatsoever. After 3 years and 8 months, I hadn't had a drink. And I left that part of the country. And it was a matter of maybe about 6 weeks. It was inevitable. There was no other way it could happen. I decided that I was going to take a drink. I had no intention of staying drunk for 7 years. That's a long time. Do any of you folks ever try to stay drunk for 7 years? You know, the next one you go out on, you might say, I'm going out and have a drink, and it might be that 7 year slip that I had. And that was the worst period of my life. It was just terrible. It reminds me of the start periods of that, you know, I vacillated back and forth. And it reminds me of the story of the fellow that's up on a 12-story building. And he's going to jump. And he didn't have quite a lot of nerve. And he'd been up there a long time, long enough to draw a crowd. And on both sides of the street, there was people with the windows open, and they were watching him. And finally, he did get enough nerve, and he made the big jump. And people that were hanging out the window watching him heard him as he was floating down. Well, everything's going all right so far. And that's about the way I felt during that 7 year period. You know, I didn't know where this thing was going to end or how it was going to end. But I just thought it had to splash. I finally determined, I thought, well, there's no other way that this can happen. I'm going to wind up on Skid Row. I'd heard so much about Skid Row in AA meetings. Well, there's no other way that it could happen. I just had to wind up on schedule. You know what and how I solved that problem? So I knew I wasn't going to wind up on Skid Row. I used to buy toothbrushes by the box, you know, and toothpaste by the box. And I had the trunk of my car filled with toothpaste and toothbrushes and soap. Made sense to me. Yeah, you talk about alcoholic insanity. Alcoholic insanity. As long as I could stay clean, I wouldn't be out on Skid Row. Yeah. Alcoholic insanity. They call it alcoholism, is it? Alcoholism? Is that what I had? Part of that, you know, is this insidious attitude that I had towards you dirty so-and-sos. And that was just as real as could be in my head. If you folks would just get the hell off of my back and leave me alone, now there was nothing wrong with me. I could handle this situation. Anybody that got between me and my drugs, man, I didn't like them, and I put them on my list. And you know, I had a long list, and that isn't too bad. I had a list as long as my arm, and that isn't too bad. But finally, you know, I wind up, I'm down in Florida, and I'm absolutely alone. My list, and I had you all on that list. Everybody was there. And I was absolutely alone. During this period, I've known a lot of people. I'd had, I don't know how many wives. I was, as I mentioned earlier before, I was a marrying drunk. You know, I was always marrying some gal that didn't have a washing machine. She didn't have a refrigerator. She didn't have pots and pans. I bought more damn pots and pans and washing machines and dryers. But it was nice, you know, when I want to leave, all I had, well, keep your damn washing machine, baby. I'm going down the street, you know. But I wind up down in Florida, and I'm absolutely alone. And picture this, I'm in a motel, and I had gone down there in November. This was at the tail end of this 7-year drunk. And I don't know how many jugs I'm setting on my dresser at various levels. I had part of a case of whiskey in the trunk of my car. I wasn't rich, but I wasn't broke. And all of a sudden, I get up one morning, and I didn't take a drink. And, you know, I hadn't allowed myself to have a hangover up to that point. I just stayed drunk. That's easier than having a hangover. But I found out what a real hangover consisted of. I was crawling on my hands and knees into the jar, and I'd take a glass of water and throw it up. And this didn't go for just a few hours. This went on for a number of days. And the maids would come in, and I'd call them over there every couple of hours and have them change the sheets and the pillowcases. I was in and out of sweats and chills, and they'd say, well, we're going to call an ambulance. I got myself into this, and I'll get myself off now. Alcoholic insanity. You know, it's hard for us to think, to believe that we're just drunk. You know, it's insane. It's insanity. I had the cutest little girl. She had the prettiest face that you can imagine. She used to come, she'd sit on the edge of my bed. She had just the cutest face that you ever saw. She was always nude, no clothes. I mean, you know, not these bikinis even that they're wearing now. She was nude. But she had a problem. She had long folds of skin that hung from her jaws down over her body here, you know, in folds like draperies, you know. You talk about insane. Here, I'm so damn sick that I don't know where I'm doing. Sex. You know, I don't, you folks don't know about this, how sex and booze are tied together, you know. In my case, they happen to be, you know. I'd like to see her breast, and I'd nudge her. I think, well, if she moved a little bit, that skin would move, and I'd be able to get feet, you know. I'd nudge her, and she'd move quick, and the damn skin would move with her. I'd throw a pillow at her, and she'd go away. And I'd wake up, and she'd be there. That's fun. You know what we alcoholics go through and call it fun? You know? I wonder today, you know, how our bodies and our minds ever come through, and what we subjected our bodies and our head, how we ever got through it at all, how we ever got through it at all. I finally got to the point after 10 days, 2 weeks, that I could go out and sit by the pool, and people would come by and they'd say, "Hi, Doc, how you doing?" Hell, I didn't know anybody. I'd been in a blackout. And it was just driving me nuts. It was driving me buggy. And after about 5 weeks, I decided I was getting well enough then that I could drive my car, but I, you know, somebody would toot a horn. And I thought, well, I just got to do something about this. I've got to get out of this some way or another. And I got some maps out one day, and I started looking at them, and I picked out Atlanta. I never screwed up in Atlanta. Never married anybody in Atlanta. So I got my car. And typical alcoholic, you know, you'd think you'd wait until morning, start out in the morning to drive from Fort Lauderdale to Atlanta. But I decided at 4 o'clock in the afternoon that I was going to go, and I got in my car and drove all night. Knew absolutely nobody there, had absolutely no reason to be there. But I drove all night to get there. And I well remember on that trip up there, you see, I was an old-time AA. I knew what AA was all about, and I well remember diving up there. Yeah. Maybe when I get up there, I can do something for those folks in AA. And it was real to me again, real, you know. We talk about alcoholic insanity, and it applies to Helen here, and not to me, not to me. It wasn't me that was insane. That was real to me, that I could maybe help those folks in AA that was up in Atlanta. But I got up there, and I checked into got there on a Saturday morning, and I checked into a motel, and lay down, and it was the first time that I had gone into a solid, restful sleep. And I don't know how long since I hadn't had a drink in about 5 weeks. And I just slept so sound. And I got up that night and got the phone book out and made a call, and it just so happened that it was the Mabel Club that I called. And I said, "Well, come on over." And I found the place and got there, and they didn't have a meeting that night. But they welcomed me and told me if I'd come back the next day, that they would take me to a meeting. So I did get back the next day, and they started taking me to meetings. Now keep in mind that I had just come off from a 7-year drunk. I had called these people, and I was asking for help. But there again, the same pattern is during the 16-year period that I had been in. I wanted you folks to help me. I wanted to get out of the thing that I was in, whatever that thing was, I didn't know. But I didn't like where I was, and I wanted to change, and I wanted to get out. But you damn well better give it to me on my terms. And I don't know, I don't think that I had any conscious thoughts that way. But that's the way it was. That's the way it was. I started going to meetings. Now I went to a meeting. They didn't have meetings that they have now. They didn't have the afternoon and the morning meetings and the 7 o'clock morning meetings that we have there now and the cocktail hour meetings. All they had was meetings scattered around town, most of them at 8 o'clock. But I went to a meeting every night. I went to a meeting every night. I'd leave my motel and I'd go to the club and I'd sit there all day. And there was always a bunch of losers sitting around there, the same as I was, you know. And we all talked. And at night, we'd go to a meeting, and I'd come back and stay at the club until they closed. I never had anybody offer me a drink in a club, so I stayed sober. I stayed dry, anyway. But here I'm going to meetings, and I'm so desperately in need. I had absolutely no idea where my kids were. My life was in shambles. I was unemployable. I was so fogged up, I couldn't get anything. You know, I couldn't remember what my daughter's name was. And if you want something to bug you, go up and ask somebody what your daughter's name is. You know, it might frighten you a little bit. And you'd think that might open something up here that I could accept. what was being offered to me with love and affection and freely. And I don't know, I don't think that I had a conscious thought. Well, these people are all wrong, and this is wrong, and I'm not going to listen to them. I don't know. I just had a closed mind. And you see, a bad thing happened to me during that period. My health started to return. Hell, I was eating good, and putting on some weight, and I was getting back. Hell, I was ready to almost get back in the ring, you know. You see, there was a period there at first. The one thing that I did have was gratitude. Every night I'd go to bed and I'd just so filled with gratitude that I didn't have a drink that day. Didn't have a drink. But then as my health started to return, my gratitude started floating away. You know? Started leaving me. Damn. I know, I should go into this in great detail because I know none of you folks have ever thought this way. I started thinking that maybe a drink could be good for me. You know, I could handle a drink. And hell, it wouldn't, just one little drink, hell, it'd make me feel I'd sleep better. Yeah. Hell, a drink. A bottle of beer never hurt any, not a damn one of you people. A bottle of beer never hurt one of you guys. It wouldn't hurt me either. That'll be all right for me to have it. And that started to become so real. I was saying to a friend of mine today, man, I don't allow myself to get in those kind of arguments today. Anytime that I get in an argument with myself, that a bottle of beer or a bottle or a shot of booze, whatever it may be, is going to be good, I'm going to lose that argument. There's no way in the world that this alcoholic can win an argument with myself when I start getting into that rationalization that I can get away with it and it's going to be good for me and so forth. But every day, it was just, I was doing what I call white knuckling, you know, and every day it was a little bit worse. And every day then it started getting, instead of me wanting to get over there to that club and go to an AA meeting, it became a chore. Well, shall I go over there or should I not? You know, maybe if I just, I guess it'd be all right if I just tested. What the hell's wrong with a little test, you know? I can do a little testing. Just as real as thoughts are just as real to me as could be. The one thing that I had done during that period that was right, I had asked a man to be my sponsor. Some of you folks, Jim is dead today, Jim Pippin is his name. He's a very powerful man, very dedicated to AA. Just speak to him. He was just one of these special AA people. And I had asked him to be my sponsor. And Jim seemed to sense what I was going through and how, you know, how tight I was and rah, rah. So he caught me out in the parking lot of the club one night and asked me what my problems were. And I started reeling them off. And I had all kinds of problems. I didn't know where my kids were. I'm running out of money. Rah, rah, you know, all kinds of problems. And he sat very patiently and listened to me for perhaps an hour. I don't know how long. And finally, when I got through, or maybe he cut me off, he said, Doc, he said, you got all these problems. And he said, there's one thing that you have forgot to list. He said, you've never, ever said one thing about you. You're the problem. He said, now you take Doc and you put him up here at the top of your list. And you take care of Doc and forget all this other hogwash that you're talking about. So I finally drummed that into my head. I said, there's another thing, a couple of more things that I want you to do tonight. He said, number one, when you go back to your room, you take 4 hours and you take these 12 steps and you study them. And you make sure that you know what is in them. You make sure you break them down and you try to determine how you're going to use them in your daily living. Not how you're going to tell me about them, but how you are going to. What do they mean to you? So and then he said, when you get through with that, well, you thank God that you haven't had a drink today. And when you get up tomorrow morning, the first thing you do, not the second thing. He said, by the time you get in a John, it's too late, baby. You had a bad thought by then. The first thing you do is get down on your knees. So when he got through talking, I said, well, Jim, I'll study these steps. But as far as thanking God is concerned, I don't think he's there, and I know if he is there, he doesn't want any part of me. And I kept telling Jim about it. I said, what the hell are you trying to do? Jim, you're trying to make a hypocrite out of me. Listen, I don't want to be a hypocrite. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine me thinking that? So finally he said, well, listen, we don't need to talk about this. He said, either you want to do this or get another sponsor. It's very simple. I don't care whether you do it or not, you know. So I very condescendingly finally consented. I thought, well, okay, I'll do it. So I didn't do that. And folks, it was a revelation to me. I didn't know. As many meetings, and I'd been to hundreds and hundreds of AA meetings during that 16-year period, and I didn't know who was in those 12 steps. I didn't know how I could use them in my daily living. I had no idea whatsoever. It was a surprise to me what was there. And I did say thanks, and I went to sleep. And when I got up the next morning, I did get down on my knees. And I didn't have any bells ring. I didn't have any light flashes, no warm noise. But the simple act of putting my body in that position, even though I was a non-believer, it did something for me. You know, back during these other years that I've talked about, during that 16-year period, there was occasionally at times when somebody would talk to me about it, and I'd be sitting on the john, and I'd think, well, I'll try a little prayer. I'd be shaven. You know, it didn't mean anything. It didn't mean anything. But by putting my body in that position, it did mean something to me. And the one thing that I know it meant at that time, it brought on a little bit of self-honesty. Probably the first real honesty that I had had as an adult. And I'm glad to report to you tonight that that was in August. Of 1967, and I've done that every morning since, and I never ever had a compulsion to take a drink since then. And man, that's freedom. That's freedom for this alcohol. Man, that's living high. That's high on the hog. That's high on the hog. I'm of the firm belief. You know, there was a time, you hear this quite often, and almost invariably every day I hear it, people talking about their program. And I used to wonder, well, what is my program? What is my program? And there was a time when I used to tell people, well, I think that if I would, if I get down on my knees each morning and if I take the 10-15 minutes at night and review my day, take that inventory. By the way, anybody that hasn't done that, you might try. It's the finest exercise that was ever given to me. It's that 10-15 minutes at night. It's done more for my self-honesty than anything. You know, when I first started doing it, I used to, I'd think, well, now why did I react the way I did with so-and-so this morning? Why did I get out? Why did I kick him in the shins? Why did I do this, you know? And the first thing, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I got that thing whirling up there like a lot of drunks have. And I think like an alcoholic. And I'd say, why did I do that at 11 o'clock? And the first thing I know, you know, well, the son of a bitch, if they hadn't been my mom, I wouldn't have done what I did, you know. So I went for a long time taking that inventory, and man, it was worse for me than not taking it at all. Because I was back into that rationalization. I was laying all the responsibility on somebody else and taking none of my own. So then finally somebody suggested to me, well, when you start doing this, say, well, God, come here and sit down here in the bed with me and let's do this together. And for some reason or other, that keeps me honest. That keeps me honest. When I take that inventory, then it means something. So anyway, I thought for quite a while, when they talk about what is your program, my program, I thought, and I thought that it would be able to sustain me. I thought, well, if I ever was able not to go to AA meetings, if I was out here on an island, or wherever it may be, that if I would do this thing in the morning of getting down on my knees, I'd take these few minutes at night to do my inventory with the help of God, and then say thank you. That is my program, and that would be able to make it through. I've gone through a lot of phases of different thinking, and you know, that's one of the things, and a lot of the things that has kept it so exciting for me is that my values today are different than they were a year ago and different than 5 years ago. It's continuous change of values and change of thoughts and so forth. Today, what I believe, and I was so glad when I walked into this room, I was so glad that you folks are here. Because you are my program, baby. You are the ones that keep me sober. I'm thoroughly convinced that being an alcoholic that I am, that if it weren't for you people, and that if I wasn't continually associated with you people, some morning I would get up and I had to go bad, and I think, well, I'll do it in a minute. And I'd go over here and I'd get away with it. See, I wouldn't get drunk that day. And that's, oh man, when I get away with something, oh, that's terrible. That's hard on me. It isn't good for me to get away with anything. You know, then I'd be skipping a couple mornings in a row, and then I'd be too busy or sleepy at night, and I wouldn't do my inventory. It's you folks who keep me on the ball, and I'm so glad that you're here. I want to thank you folks for asking me to be here tonight, and I want to thank you so much for you being here. I asked my present sponsor, he's got 35 years in the program, I asked him one time, what is the most important thing that you have learned in your 35 years in the program? And he thought for a minute and he said, well, you know, it isn't too awfully important that you folks love me, but it's damned awfully important that I love you. Thank you.